In Africa, a lot of our things are bought cash because there's lack of access to financial products.
Hello everyone, welcome to the latest episode of our podcast, Driving Eco-Sustainability, My Perspective, where we talk about everything climate change, climate action, climate solutions, and environmental sustainability. And today we are going to be delving into embracing e-mobility in the fight against climate change in our cities. And I'm pleased to be joined by a gentleman called Geoffrey. That's all I know about him, but he's going to share more about himself. And I am your host, Grace. Thank you. Welcome, Geoffrey.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Eco-sustainability is a very interesting buzzword. What does eco-sustainability mean? I know you're supposed to be the interviewer in this case, but yes. I'm just curious.
Yes, so eco-sustainability, actually, sustainability is about using our resources, bearing in mind that we are balancing the needs of present generations, but also not forgetting the future generations. We are not supposed to be using our resources only thinking of the now, but we are supposed to think about the future as well. So when we tie in the eco, it's more about our environment. So that's how we come to talk about and also shape conversations around eco-sustainability.
Okay, that's good to know. At least now I know where the whole podcast name comes from.
Yes. So basically, and my perspective is about the fact that getting people who are doing work in this space to share their honest perspectives. And it's based on the fact that no answer is wrong, no perspective is wrong. Yeah. Everyone has their own way they view eco-sustainability and the fight against climate change. So, So, Geoffrey, tell us more about yourself, really. Who is Geoffrey and what are you doing, basically, in advancing the cause for eco-sustainability?
So, I'd like to maybe just introduce, well, on a personal level and then on a philosophical level, what I believe in and then my work. So, I'll break it into those three things. So, personally, I'm Ugandan by birth, African at heart. I've always loved video games ever since I was young, and technology and all of this stuff. So that's how I get into the tech world.
Yes.
And I've always also loved cycling and being active and exploration. So that's how I get into mobility. And I've always wanted to do something bigger. And I've always felt like I was meant for, you know, a very, you know, for meant to do something big.
Yes.
And that's typically how this ties into what I decided to do with my life. So on a deeply philosophical level, what I do believe in is that service to others is the rent we pay on earth. So if we serve others and make the world a better place.
Yes.
And we are sort of making, you know, this world more bearable, making the world more comfortable, making it more sustainable. And you're basically making both your life and other people's lives better in one way or another.
Yes.
And one of the ways to do that is through development. So for every industrial revolution that has happened, there's three general purpose use technologies that have come together to make that industrial revolution happen.
Yes.
And in many cases, those are new forms of transportation, new forms of communication, and new forms of energy to power the transportation and the communication.
Yes.
But when you look at these three things, it's not just these three things alone, right? There's a lot of technologies underlying. And there's also, you know, that one thing that if you solved will typically have a knock-on effect on everything
else. A tipping point for everything else.
Exactly. Yes. And that's why energy is such an important thing, because it then powers the communication and the transportation, which are now the three fundamental things that have always run the world from the first industrial revolution to date.
Yes.
So when I was about 25, I chose to focus at least the next 25 years on advancing the energy access and, you know, advancing access to energy in Africa and probably the whole world? Because I know if we solve that energy piece, we'll be able to solve a lot of other things.
Yes.
And if we know how to use energy sustainably, then, you know, we're onto something really good. But energy doesn't exist in its own right. Like, it's almost the same way you'd see someone talk about ICT.
Yes.
ICT isn't something that stands alone.
Yes.
Or business is not something that stands alone.
Yes.
Business, ICT, all of these things merge and fuse into,
yes,
you know,
the
how does ICT fit into logistics, and how does business fit into logistics? And
yes,
then you have a more efficient, more viable logistics,
yes,
business.
Yes.
And all of these things. So you find that even energy in itself is not just energy. Energy is only useful if you're using it for something.
Yes.
That's why mobility is one of those interesting things. So currently, a friend of mine likes to call me the chief future officer. So I am the chief future officer, in a way, of a company called Kara.
Yes.
And what Kara does is we are building a product that can electrify, or that is electrifying, bicycles. So bicycles have always been known to be, in Uganda, we call them manigachifuwa.
Yes.
Because of, you know, how much effort you have to put in to basically move from one point to another. So we are basically taking the effort out of cycling, but not just for fun, right? Because there's a lot of people who cycle for recreational activities, who cycle for commute, who cycle for work.
Yes.
Carrying cargo or doing all kinds of things. And for us, it's really for commercial and livelihoods. That's where we really have been able to, you know, come in and provide a solution that improves, you know, economic outcomes and also improves livelihoods. So the electrification kits that we provide go onto bicycles that are transporting food in urban areas,
yes,
or food delivery guys. You have them going into bicycles that transport milk in rural areas,
yes,
from like a farm to a milk collection center, or from a dairy depot in the city to, you know, small shops. And what that typically does is it creates a more efficient and more sustainable value chain that someone who's been using a bicycle, a traditional bicycle, to move goods and services manually.
Yes.
Is now able to do that more efficiently, able to earn more,
yes,
able to work for more hours and essentially make more money, or able to free up some of his time to spend with his family and, you know, all of that. And able to, as this afterthought, able to do it sustainably.
Yes.
Because I think if we put sustainability at the front of the agenda, you kind of miss the point. You kind of make it look like, you know, sustainability is the most important thing. But I think it needs to be something that's baked into everything we,
yes,
do, and not something that stands alone.
Yes.
Because then a lot of things will not make sense. You'll have a very sustainable but very expensive form of transportation. Yes, you've achieved the sustainability, but is it actually accessible? Is it affordable? And is it deliver the right value? So in a nutshell, that's what Kara does.
Yes.
That's what I believe in, and that's who I am.
Yes. Now, you've mentioned, you know, for me, I've been pronouncing Kara as Kara, a name, but I notice you're calling it Kara. Like, you know, it used to be a slang when we were growing up in school. Uh-huh. Kara meaning electricity.
Yes.
And in fact, some of us, I will confess, have had a hard time to adjust in ordinary conversations when we are talking about electricity. You don't say, we don't have power anymore. You will say, Kara has chucked. And then you remember, this used to be a slang. So yes, for me, it has been an observation I've made that it's actually Kara bikes.
Yeah.
Yes. So yes, now I can see, Geoffrey, that for you, this is more than just about selling electric bikes. And it's more of a vision being built for the future to effectively transform the transport industry, not only in Uganda, but Africa as well. Now, you will notice that most of the people who come into the space who are innovative and passionate for the future in Uganda and Africa all through, we struggle with the fact that our markets are not ready, but also the infrastructure is not in place to support or enable the rollout of our innovations. And so people always get frustrated and they bail out and they move on to other markets which they think are more favorable.
Yeah.
So what makes Kara the unique innovation and one that is going to stand the test of time?
So the interesting thing is you always want to decouple things, right? So in many cases, when an innovator is innovating on something, like creating something new and, you know, we're going to disrupt this and we're going to change this, in many cases, they are forgetting that there's already something that has been existing and they're choosing to ignore everything that is already existing and saying, oh, we want to create, you know, a new way of transportation. What Kara is doing is not creating anything new. It's we're improving what's existing. Now, in regards to how we're doing that, and that's really the unique piece, because we realize that selling bicycles is, yeah, like people have been selling bicycles since. Bicycles have been made for more than 100 years.
Yes.
So when you look at bicycles as a form of transportation, so let me reference something right here. Bicycles have always been seen as just bicycles, right? But if you look at the forms of transportation, one of the most efficient forms of transportation is actually a bicycle of forms of human transportation.
I think because it's convenient, really. It's convenient.
Let me just pull up that research I did. So if you compare,
yes,
for every kilometer that you walk,
yes,
so walking you have to spend 75. So if you're walking as a human being, for a 70 kilogram human being, which is about my weight, you have to spend 75 kilocalories of energy to walk for 1 kilometer. For cycling, like actual normal cycling,
yes,
you'd have to spend between 30 to 50 kilocalories. Electric bicycle, with an electric bicycle, you'll spend about 10 to 20. Now, all of this might sound like something very complicated, but in comparison, a kilocalorie, and I did a very interesting breakdown. A kilocalorie is worth, in terms of food, is worth about, so to walk, you'd have to use, I need to organize my research a lot more, but essentially you'd have to eat about a banana for walking 10 kilometers. And then you'd only have to eat about half a banana, and you have to eat much less than a banana to cycle. Much less than half of a banana to cycle. If you do like an energy comparison of what you do, how much energy you'd need. So essentially, cycling is very efficient as a form of human transportation, and using an electric bicycle in that sense is way more efficient. However, we looked at the most efficient way, actually, I would say, deliver or increase access to electric bicycles. And we noticed that it's not about selling bicycles. It's about empowering companies that are already selling bicycles.
Yes.
And people who already have bicycles.
Yes.
To then make that more efficient.
Yes.
So what we're doing at the moment is we now work with a lot of bicycle shops. We work with bicycle manufacturers, we work with bicycle importers to add this electrification system, even bicycle owners, to add this electrification system to their bicycle. So you don't have to go and buy a new electric bicycle. You can go to your bicycle shop, pick out a bicycle you want, and say, oh, add Kara to this bicycle.
Okay.
And that's the goal, because that way you can actually do it much faster, you can do it much cheaper. And electrification in general is about half, electrifying a bicycle is about half the cost of a new electric bicycle. So if you were to buy a new bicycle versus electrifying your existing bicycle, you typically spend, you know, all in plus the bicycle about 25% less.
Okay.
So one of the things that we're really trying to do is take the most efficient path. Now, in principle, in terms of infrastructure, we found that the interesting thing about infrastructure is that infrastructure develops as people start to use it.
Yes.
Now, I'll give you an example. We're currently, you know, somewhere in, which road is this? Lumumba? No, not Lumumba Avenue. William Street? It's William Street down. One of these roads.
I think the one coming from Bakuli going down to Central Business District, Kampala, is that road where they had said it's a non-motorized corridor.
So we have an NMT corridor running less than 500 meters or a kilometer from where we are right now. This was fully funded by the government of Uganda. And when you go onto that road, you'll find a ton of bicycles parked there. You'll find people cycling. Of course, there's an overwhelming amount of people selling merchandise on the non-motorized transport corridors. There are border boarders on the NMT. But besides that, right, it shows that there are, to some extent, a good number of people who are actually using the product using bicycles.
Yes. Now, Geoffrey, at that point, that's mm-hmm. where I come to ask that, why are you choosing the conversion approach where you're already dealing with existing motorbikes other than going...
Existing bicycles.
Yes. Bicycles, other than going on a full-fledged production and assembling of new electric bikes. Someone would be wondering if you're cutting costs or informally cutting corners, or is it an innovation or is it more of a compromise?
So if you look at the distribution chain of a product, we wouldn't be adding any more value if we built a whole new electric bicycle company.
Yes.
Because what are you doing? You're recreating the distribution, the assembly, the manufacturing of things that are already being manufactured anyway. And secondly, you're also creating a whole new brand, creating different variations. Mm. So different people want like a sports bike, a cargo bike, this bike. And then you're doing all of these complicated things. But yet, if you actually just electrified what's existing, you're able to avoid all of that work and you spend a lot more time doing what actually needs to be done and less time actually, as they say, reinventing the wheel. So for us, it's really about the most efficient way to achieve the goal. If we were to put 1,000, let's say 1 million bicycles on the road, 1 million electric bicycles on the road, and we had to also, one, make, distribute, sell, market the new bicycles.
Yes.
Versus if we had to electrify 1 million bicycles, the electrification path is actually faster and cheaper and more collaborative. So we are basically doing a lot of collaborations with companies like World Bicycle Relief, Buffalo Bicycles. We're doing a lot of collaboration with companies like Sawan and Ref Bicycles. And many other bicycle brands that we're, you know, working with.
Yes.
And essentially, our system is just plugging into an existing value chain because that's actually more efficient in terms of delivering this goal. And, you know, the reason why, and going back to the goal of this podcast and, you know, why we're actually here, climate change is here. It's not something that's now far off. It's not something in the distance that we're just hearing about.
Yes.
It is here.
Yes.
If you're building any solutions in the climate change space, you're either doing one of three things. You're doing adaptation, mitigation, and resilience.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Now, on the mitigation side, every single day, CO2 emissions are always growing.
Yes.
And it's not going to, you're not going to have the luxury of time to solve the problem in your own time.
Yes.
You have to solve it fast and you have to apply a certain level of urgency.
Yes. No.
And that's where that's why we chose a path that values expedience than a more luxurious path.
Yes.
Because this thing that we're talking about is literally in the room.
Yes.
It's not something we just hear about.
Yes.
Yeah.
Actually, before I go to talk to you, I also had the same question. I would be wondering why someone is not going on a full-fledged production and they are working with what's available. So at least, yes, I've been able to understand the difference and the benefits of each. So now, e-mobility is traded as, when people are marketing e-mobility, transport, one of the things they always tell us out there that it's going to help reduce carbon emissions. Now, is this real or it's just people looking to make money and people looking to cash in on their innovations, really? Because if we are going to say that we are transitioning from fossil fuel empowered transport to e-mobility, and actually, the main thing people say is that it helps with reduction of carbon emissions,
yes,
and therefore contributing to climate action. Is this real or it's just something people are making up?
They call it, the right word you're looking for is greenwashing.
Yes. I actually didn't want to say greenwashing. I wanted to be kind about it. Yes.
But look at it this way. I think I will speak for the field that I am in. A lithium-ion battery is not a zero-emissions product. There are a lot of emissions associated with batteries in the life cycle of their production. However, there are less or close to zero emissions in the use of lithium-ion batteries. And lithium-ion batteries typically have a better well-to-wheel efficiency or energy efficiency compared to fuel. So the amount of fuel you need to burn to travel a kilometer in a car versus the amount of electricity you'd have to spend to travel the same kilometer is significantly less, much, much less. Because when you're doing the combustion process, there's a lot of energy loss to heat, conversion losses, and a lot of inefficiencies in the ICE or internal combustion engine vehicle, right? So because of those energy losses, that alone should be a driver for transition. That's the first thing. The second thing is, like it or not, the lithium-ion battery is not a clean asset. You're destroying the earth to mine these minerals, the cobalt, the lithium, the nickel, the manganese, the alumina, and all of these minerals that you typically need to put together this battery. You're spending even more money to process those minerals, which is spending a lot more energy and emitting more in the production process to actually produce or refine these products. However, when this battery gets onto the road in an electric bicycle, an electric car, an electric anything, the amount of service life that it has. So, for example, for an electric bicycle battery, you're taking the average, will do about 1,000 cycles. 1,000 cycles is 1,000 charges and discharges. When you do 1,000 cycles, it drops down to an efficiency of about 80%. So if it used to give you 100 kilometers, it will be giving you, let's say, 80. But it still has 80% of its original capacity. So it can then be used in like a more stationary storage product.
Mm.
And then it will get down to maybe give it, so 1,000 cycles, give that about 2 to 3 years. The other 80%, give it about, 5 to 7 years in a stationary application.
Yes.
And then interestingly, you can actually recycle this battery.
Okay.
So with a lot of smart batteries.
Yes.
You can now embed a lot of sensors and trackers and systems that enable you to monitor the life cycle of this battery and eventually take it back to the factory. And now at the factory, you're not starting from mining. You're starting from the battery itself with the minerals already in there. And you can get about 80 to 95% of the original minerals you put in to make a whole new battery.
Wow.
So it then becomes a circular thing, yes, where you now start doing what you'd call urban mining.
Yes.
And you're basically getting the batteries which were already produced, putting them back into the production process and creating new batteries. So, and that's what sustainability is, yes, all about. Yes, yes. It's not about stopping to, you know, mine or consume energy, yes, or emit.
But it's also about responsible production and consumption.
Exactly. Yes. And this, if you've noticed, requires action for multiple stakeholders. It requires the customer to be mindful of recycling. It requires the user to be mindful of second life and third life applications.
Yes.
It requires the you know, regulation, the logistics.
Yes.
And all of this to work together. And even the production, you know, the companies that produce the batteries, to work together to contribute to this sustainable value chain.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
It's not something that one person can do alone. So, yes. So that's how I would say this product is not just a joke, at least in how it's being done. There are people that are, or there are actors in this field that are, I would say, just greenwashing, right? And deploying things like things that don't really move the needle, or that look like they're sustainable but are not really changing or taking bold steps. And in many cases, it's out of fear. Out of fear of changing the status quo.
Yes.
If we move away from this thing, will we have enough batteries?
Yes.
But it's the same way, you know, if we don't move away from USAID,
yes,
will we have independent economies,
yes,
that can actually, you know, that can actually support themselves? So I think the main goal here is weaning ourselves off of this old, yes, form of energy consumption.
Yes.
And it's weaning. It's not
drastic.
It's not drastic change. It's,
yes,
not taking a child from breast milk and directly giving him a lump of you know, solid food.
Yes.
It's a process that's you know,
that has to continuous. It's a continuous.
Exactly.
Process.
Yes.
Yes. So now, Geoffrey, in the spirit of making this process continuous, mm-hmm, we are seeing, yes, e-mobility comes up and we are pushing our people to embrace it. We are pushing people to take it on. But, you know, one of the tenets of sustainability, for it to work, we also have to address the affordability question.
Yep.
We are wondering, how do we get people from point A to point B? So we have to factor in affordability. Now, is e-mobility, and as it stands right now, is immobility more of a luxury and less of a necessity? What is Kara Bikes doing to make it more affordable?
So what Kara is doing, I can't start by, you know, speaking about what Kara is doing. I'll probably start by talking about the affordability question in general for immobility, because it applies to everyone.
Yes.
There is something called total cost of ownership. And that's something that a lot of customers have to start to learn. I'll give you a very simple example. The bicycle I ride to work and back costs almost the same as a motorcycle, right?
Yes.
That bicycle covers 100 kilometers on one charge. So I can ride at crazy speeds and, you know, in any setting I want, up and down all the hills I want, for 2 to 3 days. Because my commute is about 20 kilometers, so 10 kilometers to work and back. However, this bicycle, despite costing about close to 5 million shillings, which is about the same price you'd buy a motorcycle, a Bajaj motorcycle,
yes,
brand new,
mm,
only costs me 500 shillings to charge to travel for 3 days.
Wow.
If I was to take a border, a safe border or a normal border to work, I would have to spend how much? About, for the same distance, 5,000 shillings to go to work, 5,000 shillings to come back. If I was to drive, I'll spend maybe 10 to 20,000 shillings, including jam and all of this stuff. So I would say the total cost of ownership across, if I was to calculate my electricity cost associated with charging my electric bicycle battery in a week, it's actually how much I spend on electricity at home in a month would be what I spend on transport in, let's say, even 3 days.
Okay.
So the charging cost versus the usage cost is something a lot of customers have failed to understand. And in this, the same thing applies to electric cars. The efficiency of how much electricity you need. So you need, for you to cover about 200 to 300 kilometers, you need a 75 kilowatt battery. 75 kilowatt battery at, let's say, 1,000 shillings per kilowatt of charge is 75,000 shillings. If you're to drive 300 kilometers in an SUV, you typically need on the order of magnitude of about 300 to 400,000 shillings worth of fuel to do 300 kilometers of travel. So it's the cost of ownership that customers have failed to understand, but also it's that in certain economies, the access to financial tools and financial systems is more prominent, that yes. You can finance a product yes. over time.
Yes.
So financial literacy is still a very big gap. Yes. Because whereas you can buy an electric car in the US or in developed markets and pay for it over time
yes.
and benefit from that total cost of ownership where you're just paying a piece every month or every week or every whatever period, in Africa, a lot of our things are bought cash because there's lack of access to financial products. So you can't easily go to a bank and get an affordable loan to get yourself an electric bicycle, an electric motorcycle. And that's part of the work that we're doing as CARA, you know, working with financial institutions to educate them and sensitize them on how to design e-mobility products, financing for e-mobility products. We're currently, as of this year, one of our biggest things that we're working on is an embedded asset financing tool that will enable asset financing companies to use to easily enforce right to own or, you know, flexible financing products into this e-mobility product that we've built. So it's something that the financiers have to meet us halfway, and the customers also have to meet us halfway, because if the customer doesn't understand total cost of ownership and the financier doesn't understand how to finance this customer to be able to, you know, access that product, and then the government also doesn't know how to, you know, structure this in the right way to ensure that there's a very lubricated discussion between the manufacturers, the customers, and the financiers, then it all becomes very difficult to do.
Yes. So, Geoffrey, now at the point where we are seeing that we need to meet each other halfway.
Yes.
Every stakeholder needs to meet the other halfway.
Yeah.
Now, we have to appreciate that as Ugandans, we love our comfort. And we are seeing more petrol stations coming up and more motor vehicles on the roads, motorbikes on the road, which has caused a big problem of traffic jam in Kampala. In fact, we waste a lot of time on the road these days than ever before. But when you look for charging stations for electricity, replacement of batteries, those are few. In fact, it's a sight to behold if you see one. I think I've only seen one at Amber House.
Interestingly, they are not few.
Yes.
I'll ask you a very simple question. Countrywide, and everyone I ask this question fails it. Almost everyone. How many Shell fuel stations are in Uganda?
I honestly wouldn't
give me a ballpark figure.
I wouldn't know. I can't really tell because I've not been to all the parts of the country.
Yes. But I can tell you they are less than 300 fuel stations by Shell. About 200 and something. Total, another 200 and something. Not even 250 for any of the two. And this is countrywide. However, in Kampala alone, just one e-mobility company I know has at least 25 swap stations. For how many motorcycles? About 1,000 motorcycles. So if you compare the amount of charging and swap stations and the amount of fuel stations, there's a big mismatch.
Yes, Geoffrey, I will hold you right there. Despite the fact that, yes, there is a disparity, and when you compare the fuel stations vis-a-vis the charging stations, of course, this I can tell that the charging stations are efficiently meeting the motorcycles which are on market.
Actually above and beyond.
Yes, but why is it still a problem for us to still adopt e-mobility? Because we are still struggling with the fact that, yes, the cycling lanes are there, but we are still abusing them. They still have motorbikes. People are trading and doing business there. How do you convince someone that this is not only the future, but it's actually better?
So I'll give you an example. Just next door in Kenya, I think, it's only electric motorcycles allowed to go into the CBD. Fuel motorcycles are not allowed. Those are incentives that are created. In some countries, I think they allow electric cars to drive in bus lanes and avoid traffic.
Okay.
Some, you know, buildings in more developed countries is actually installing charging points for electric cars.
Yes.
I think the infrastructure problem is something that is going to be solved over time. Because I can tell you for a fact, if you came and covered the whole of Kampala in charging stations, you'd probably not see significantly more electric cars and motorcycles and bicycles. So I think it needs to grow organically, because as the infrastructure grows, the, you know, adoption also grows. It's not something that will happen in a snap of a finger. However, like I mentioned earlier, one company, one e-mobility company, has 25 swap stations.
Yes.
A fuel company that has been in Uganda for so many years, like a very big one at that, an international company, has about 250 in the whole of the country. So I think we're measuring e-mobility with a very harsh, you know,
giving it a tougher yard.
Exactly, right?
Yes.
Because, you know, there's less than 5,000 electric motorcycles on the road. There's less than 200 electric cars in Uganda.
Yes. Now,
that infrastructure that's available at the moment is sufficient. The one thing I do not agree with the electric motorcycle charging infrastructure is the visibility. So, and this is something that has been worked on, and it is being worked on by a lot of the companies. But when you see a petrol forecourt, it's like visible. It's, you know, it's
grand.
It's grand, yes. Right? Whereas when you see a swap station, it's in a small shop somewhere.
It was just there in a corner.
You see a small signpost somewhere. And I've had these discussions with a few members of the E-Mobility Association of Uganda. And it's something that you're now seeing a lot more prominent signposts. You're seeing some automated swap stations. You're seeing a lot more, you know, branding around the stations. But it's also partly visibility, I think. I think if we fix the visibility issue, we'll have a very, very, very vibrant e-mobility ecosystem.
Yes. Now, Geoffrey, a while back, I think around last year, the government in the quest to implement the e-mobility strategy, at least it came out to announce that there is need for around $1.7 billion in order to kickstart the full implementation of the e-mobility strategy in Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
And to do this, it would contribute to a massive reduction of carbon emissions. But also the bigger picture is hinged on the fact that there is need to ensure that we are not, as Uganda, we are not only consumers of e-mobility, but we can also produce and be self-sustainable. But against that, we would also note that the government recently reinstated the tax on e-mobility.
And I will tell you.
Yes, and when asked, at least out there, they will say that we want to incentivize
local production.
Yes. Yes. So now this back and forth, someone would be wondering, are our policies really working for us? Are government policies working? Because in most times people feel like the government policies are there, but when it comes to implementation and practical use, then there is a disjuncture.
So what's interesting is, and I do agree with the government saying that, you know what, we need a lot more local input into, you know, into the e-mobility ecosystem. Because if you're going to import everything you use, then it doesn't really make sense. But also if you're going to produce everything you use, it also doesn't make sense. So there's a valid point on the government side, but there's also a valid point on the private sector side. If I wanted to, I will compare, for example, producing an electric bicycle battery in Uganda. Where am I going to source cells? The cells are going to come from China, which produces, by the way, 70% of the world's batteries, lithium-ion batteries. Secondly, yes, you'll say that there are minerals here, but I'll just give you one example of the minerals. Yes, we have all the minerals in Africa, but 3 out of 4 of the world's cobalt refineries are in China. Mineral processing is also in China, at least the largest percentage of it. And that's processing and refining, right? And then when you get to the production capacity, if you want to make an e-mobility battery, for example, a battery pack, you need nickel strips, you need, you know, insulation, you need a lot of these supplies. You need small microelectronics and control boards and battery management systems. Majority of those are made in China. Are we taking steps as a country to actually make this more localized? Yes. Is it going to be a leap? No, because some of these things have to be developed over time. So I feel like there needs to be a middle ground where we accept some local value addition, and we also accept a lot of technology transfer.
Yes.
If you look at China, how China has really developed is that they were deliberate and they said, oh, if you really want to sell electric cars in China,
yes,
come and get a Chinese partner, do a joint venture, build the product locally with local ecosystems. Because then this larger partner comes in with knowledge and expertise and a supply chain and, you know, the financial muscle, while you as a local partner come in with local expertise and distribution and all of this. And that is always a very good marriage. If you try to do everything locally, you will fail spectacularly. So the interesting thing is we need to walk that line.
Yes.
Not fully import, but also not fully, produced locally, because it's not something we have the supply chain. And from a company, for example, yes, that makes this, we have tried to make batteries locally. And we have, in many cases, spent way more making a local battery, a locally produced battery, than what you'd import. In many cases, even spending 2 times the amount and 5 times the effort,
yes,
to produce the same exact product with a very low quality score. So we still have a long way to go. However, I do agree 100% with the government on driving local production. I do not agree with the process that it's going to take. It's not something that will all of a sudden arrive and be done in one day.
Yes.
It's something that will have to be done over time.
Yes.
With a lot of collaboration, with a lot of, you know, synergies built with other partners.
Yes.
And if you look at, for example, and one of the biggest signs is the Kira Motors plant. Kira Motors has built, you know, a very large bus manufacturing plant. I think the largest e-mobility production facility in Africa. And they're making buses. They're making electric buses, I think over 5,000 buses per month or something like that. I've toured the facility, amazing facility. The government has invested close to $100 million in this initiative from start to finish. However, and I'll say this without really mincing my words, the commercial strategy of a government-driven company It's usually not very good. So I would say if Kira Motors was a privately driven entity, one, it wouldn't be producing that, well, setting up that big of a bus production facility. They wouldn't be bold enough to set up to make that investment.
Yes.
That's one thing that we'll agree upon. But secondly, on the commercial side, they would probably have sold more buses. You'd probably see a lot more Kira buses. So the commercial strategy of and they would have probably moved faster. Kira Motors has been around for a good number of years. Probably first time I heard about them was 2012 or something like that. So within that time, they would have, if they were a privately driven company, they would have probably gone further along.
Yes.
So I think there is a need for not just fully government driven, but public-private partnerships.
Yes.
Where, yes, the bold and, you know, ambitious government, bold, ambitious, and I would say locally, I would say patriotic strategy is important from government, but then the commercial, you know,
the commercial acumen and business association of the private sector.
Of the private sector is also required to kind of merge the two.
Yes.
Because if you just do one and not the other, the thing won't be localized. You'll just be importing things and all of that. And if you just do a pure production thing, I might as well go to China, buy a bunch of buses, ship them to Uganda, sell them, and, you know, make some money.
Yes. Geoffrey, now on that point of financing and synergies and private-public partnerships, now it's easy to have an idea, and I think I've also seen it around. Governments worry or they're afraid of the fact that most of the ideas are more of ideas and they are not implemented. Shifting from an idea to implementation of a solution seems to be an issue. Yeah. And I think that is where the biggest issue of financing comes in. How much has this impacted the scaling of the e-mobility in Uganda generally?
So I'll give you a very simple example. If I went to look for funding from a local bank to build a product like this, I would not get it. If I went to look for funding from local investors to give me money to build a venture like mine, I also probably wouldn't get it. Or I would get very little of it, and most of it would be from friends and family, which is very limited to build something of this nature. If I went to the international community to, you know, raise funding, yes, I would get the money. I mean, it would take a lot more to get it. But then the local ownership is and control is, you know, relinquished, right? So that means a lot of the returns will not stay here. They will be mostly appreciated by or received by the large private equity or venture capital or development finance.
What is called profit repatriation, right? Back.
So I do believe as Africans, we need to build our own institutions that fund local solutions. Because at the end of the day, if you don't, you'll always be on the, you know, begging side. You'll always be, you know, playing to the tunes of a certain funder in a particular country, dictating how you should run a local company. And it's not that funders are not important. To a certain level, you need foreign funding because you cannot fully grow on local sources only. But I think for the local sources of funding or support, it's also that they understand, or it's easier for them to understand why the use case of an electric over Manigachua bicycle and why it actually makes sense to electrify them, because they've probably seen a guy delivering milk at their farm in the village using a bicycle. However, that takes me now to another point. Funding is not just money. Funding is support in so many other forms. One form of funding could be capital, like actual cash. Another form of funding could be mentorship or knowledge. Another form of funding could be debt. So there's so many forms of capital that need to converge to ensure that this, you know, business or these ideas in the e-mobility and the sustainable mobility space actually take off. But then it also needs to be the right type of funding. I think right type of funding is even more important than just any funding.
Yes.
So funding that is context aware. A friend of mine, Badru Ntege, likes to call this context aware financing. Financing that understands what you're trying to do. And, you know, it's not just applying a broad stroke to a new business model, a new type of business. So if you walk to the bank and you're running a business that they don't understand, they'll probably see it as a very risky venture. But if they had context-aware people in this field or in the bank, they're able to understand, okay, you're building an electric bicycle product. You import some components from different places, different countries. You clear taxes locally. You then produce a product and then sell it to a customer. That customer is not buying it cash. He's buying it in installments. So one, you need working capital, you need import financing, you need customer financing. And then you can also leverage all of this with a lot of concessional financing like green bonds and all of this carbon credit financing. And when you blend everything in that nature, then you find that you're not just funding a business, you're funding an ecosystem, you're funding a process that's going to deliver a product to the market, and you're giving it the right type of funding for the exact things that it needs to do, not just saying, oh, we're going to give you a loan at this price. Mm. So that's, I think, what we need more of. We need more context-aware financing, and we need a lot more collaboration. And we also need to be very cognizant of the fact that funding is not just, at times, it's a person who has done a business like yours. One of my best advisors is a guy, a Ugandan guy who worked at Tesla from 2012 to 2017. And he understands what an e-mobility company runs like. And he's seen Tesla growing from being a small, significantly smaller company to being a large automaker now. And he's Ugandan. So he understands Uganda. So this is very important because then it gives you a different lens of looking at a business. It helps you avoid so many mistakes, which you would have paid for with money.
Yes.
So that's the goal. Yeah.
Geoffrey, now, what would you say to someone? Let's presume, yes. Now, Carabikes, as I can tell, it's more than just an e-mobility company or business. It is a movement that is looking to shape the e-mobility landscape in Uganda and Africa as a whole.
Yeah.
So yes, what would you tell someone? Now you've gotten a chance. You're meeting an investor, you're meeting a president, you're meeting policyholders, people who are supposed to make things move, people who you're supposed to collaborate with, and you have that one thing you would like to share with them that would convince them that e-mobility is not the future. That immobility is actually now, it's the present, and we can't shift the conversation to the future.
Hmm. What would I tell all these people? I think I would tell them different things because everyone is interested in something different.
Hmm.
But what I would say is that I think when everything is starting, right, it's very messy. You're very unsure about what exactly to do, how to do it. Not everything is fully formed. But as you keep working on it, it gets clearer. You try this, it fails. You try that, it fails. You try this, it works. And you keep on experimenting. So even in fields and with examples of companies that have built very significantly adopted products, no one has it all figured out. And I think everyone needs to meet everyone else halfway. The policymakers need to meet the innovators and, you know, businesses halfway and kind of work with them to figure things out. The banks and financiers need to, you know, do the same. Governments need to do the same. Policymakers need to do the same. Everyone, customers also need to do the same. We had, I'll end with a story. There's a gentleman who has recently received a bicycle. And this electric bicycle is, I mean, this guy has been working in food delivery, sorry, in milk delivery in Uganda, in Kampala, right? For about, what, 30 years? Longer than I've been alive. I met this guy when I was on my way to work. I was cycling to work, and I saw him on the roadside with a bicycle. This bicycle was old. It was like the normal Roadmaster bicycles given to him by the company that he delivers for. And I said, I talked to him for a few minutes. I asked him to come to our office in Bugolobi at Motive that same day. So he came by in the evening, and without even taking any documentation, without knowing where this guy works, where he stays, his information, I gave him an electric bicycle. Told him to try it out for 2 weeks. So he rode the bicycle and he came back so impressed. The first week, the feedback was really good. Second week, the feedback was really good. This guy started delivering when he was about 19, moving milk. And now he's about 40-something. In 2 weeks, he was able to increase how much he was selling by about 100,000 shillings. 100,000 shillings gross merchandise. Within the same time, he was able to reduce how many hours he works by 3 hours by just switching to an electric bicycle. Those are 3 hours he can spend with his family, 3 hours he can, you know, take on an extra job to get more income. And then we paused because we didn't have the resources to give him an electric bicycle. We didn't have batteries at the time. We had financial challenges and all of this stuff. A few months later, about 2 months, 1 to 2 months later, I call him back. He comes in for an interview. We got some more resources and we were now able to provide him with an electric bicycle. Just this afternoon as I was coming here, I found the guy, like, I was leaving, I was getting a boarder to come, a boarder to get here. As I was waiting for my ride, I saw him across the road. So I crossed the road and I found him delivering to a supermarket I regularly buy stuff from. And he was delivering on one of our bikes. And that gave me so much joy because, to be honest, the past 2 weeks haven't been really easy because when we gave him the bicycle, we had some technical challenges with the bicycle. I mean, there was a software glitch that we had not fixed. And it took us about 2 weeks to fix that software glitch. And this guy had to visit us 3 or 4 times during those times. And he had to ride the bicycle manually. We also had to forfeit collecting on his loan until this problem was fixed because he was still having to push the bicycle up hills. But we worked together. He would come. He would leave the workshop at 7 or 8. We would try and, you know, troubleshoot. And eventually he found the solution, what, about 3 or 4 days ago. I think Wednesday or Thursday last week. And that's the definition of what it means to build solutions at the frontier or at the edge. You're figuring things out as you go and you need people to meet you halfway. If he wasn't willing to try out this bike for 2 weeks, if I wasn't willing to give him the bike and just see what happens, it wouldn't have happened. If he wasn't also willing to be patient with us, to understand that, okay, there's this technical problem, but let me, like every evening he would call me, oh, I'm done with my work, can I come over, are you around? I'll then call a technician, we'd try and fix things. And eventually we found the solution and now he's happy. And for me, that's actually what it means to build a product like this.
Yes.
To build the future. It's that this is something that we have to all contribute to.
Yes.
Because we're living on this biosphere that whatever is happening somewhere else sort of affects everyone else. So these emissions and this, you know, climate change thing, despite the fact that Africa doesn't pollute that much, we still get affected by the same emissions because any emissions in Europe will cross over to everywhere. Any emissions in Africa will also cross over everywhere. And as a growing continent, we need to build sustainability into our growth story, but we also most importantly, need to build this locally in a local driven way and not using a blueprint of some other countries and how they've developed. Yes. It needs to be driven by local companies, local innovations, but with a global outlook, with a lot of collaboration. And that's, I think, what I would say. It's a very long answer, but that's what I would definitely say.
We need to
say.
Basically buy Uganda, build Uganda. Really? But, we need to nurture local content. We need to...
I think we need to buy each other and build each other.
Yes.
Yeah, like we need to support each other. It doesn't only need to be Uganda. It needs to be Kenya, Rwanda.
Yes.
Something that works here can also, you know, go across the region and it's we then all benefit from the same thing.
Yes. Now, Geoffrey, it's really been an exciting conversation. I could go on all night or all day and us talking about e-mobility. I can tell it's a subject you're really passionate about. Now, briefly and lastly, do you think our cities are going to get it? I don't want to be a pessimist, but neither do I want to be overly optimistic. Do you think our cities are going to get it finally and understand that, yes, we don't need to have a drastic shift, but we need to take the immaculate steps and take it one day at a time and integrate e-mobility to subsist and exist together with the current means of transport that we have, so that we gradually make a change and prepare for the future?
The short answer is no. I was in Dubai last year and I spoke to a guy, an Uber driver who was driving a Tesla, leaving a networking party at one of the hotels in the city and going back to my hotel. And we had a very interesting discussion. This guy, because of the lack of infrastructure for charging, he literally has to sleep in the car lined up behind other electric vehicles that are looking to use a charging station. Instead of going home, he has to park in line to wait for a spot to free up, and then drive to the spot, charge. If a country like Dubai, which looks like they, well, a city like Dubai, which looks like they have it all figured out, can have such fundamental challenges with an e-mobility revolution that is taking the entire world by storm, then who are we? I think the cities won't get it, but the people will.
Okay.
And I think it's the people we need, not the cities, because even a government is composed of people.
Yes.
It's composed of the citizenry. And that's actually the most important thing. If the people get it, policy will follow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Thank you so much for all those who have tuned in, all those who are going to watch this episode later, and all those who are going to listen to it later. It's been an exciting conversation. It's really been thought-provoking, and we have been discussing everything e-mobility in Uganda and beyond. So, and you have heard that if we are going to make that gradual transformational shift, we need the people. We are the center. We are the heartbeat to protect our environment, to take climate action and save nature, not today, not tomorrow, but also for future generations. I've been your host, Grace. Thank you so much. Driving Eco-Sustainability, my perspective. Till next time.
Thank you so much for watching this video. I do value the time that you put in to watch every episode. The entire essence I started this channel was to enhance the reach of the voices of those people who are contributing to the fight against climate change and those who are fighting to save our environment. If you like this video, click the subscribe button so that you can equally contribute to enhancing awareness towards climate action. Let's save our planet together.